This clip was recorded live during my talk with a class in Economic Growth and Development at St. John's University in New York. The subject is the basic Congo economy and the mining industry.
The GDP is about $19 billion. That makes income about $300 a year per person. Okay? Contrast that with the United States, where our GDP per capita income is about $35,000. In the Congo, it's about $300. Now, in the Congo, of every 1,000 babies born alive, 200 of them will die before their fifth birthday. That's a mortality rate of about 20%, compared to only 8 out of 1,000 in the United States. Life expectancy in the Congo is about 49 years versus the U.S., where the average person lives to be 77. Safe water is available to practically everyone here. It may not taste good, but it's generally healthy. But it's accessible to less than half of the people in the Congo. In the Congo, 76% of the men and 55% of the women are literate. Actually, that's a little higher than you might think. It's not too bad. But of course, in the United States, our literacy rate is about 97% of both men and women. Our effective literacy rate, our actual literacy rate's a little lower than that. And we talked about the per capita income. But that gives you kind of a feel for what the Congo is about economically on a large scale. As you know, Heart of Diamonds is a book about a diamond mine, and it centers on the wealth of the Congo, which is what everyone's been fighting about for years and years and years. This is a photograph, not one of mine. All the rest of the photographs are my photographs taken in Africa when I visited Uganda and Zambia to research the novel over a period of 5 years. But this is a photograph of a very typical artisanal mine, an alluvial mine in the Congo. This is very similar to the kind of mine that was described in Heart of Diamonds. The Congo produces cobalt and copper. As I mentioned, they're one of the largest copper producers in the world. Niobium, tantalum, oil, industrial and gem diamonds, gold, silver, zinc, manganese, tin, uranium, coal. There's huge hydropower potential in the Congo. There is the river, not just the Congo River, but many of its tributaries, has the potential, it's believed, to supply enough hydroelectric power to take care of the electric needs of the entire African continent. But, of course, it's basically untapped. There are projects on the drawing board waiting funding and hopefully to be developed, as there are many other things. Congo is a nation in transition. In 2006, for the first time since 1960, elections were held, and Joseph Kabila was named president of the Congo, and a parliament was elected.
Dave?
Yes. Yes.
Do you know if I pull down view and make largest, that'll become larger?
Yes. There we go.
Okay.
Sorry about
wow.
that. Thank you for saying that. I see that. I didn't know I could do that. Okay, so you can see how primitive this is. These men are working in essence, in a huge mud hole, part of a river, digging with shovels and buckets, much like the scene that I described in Heart of Diamonds. Let me give you a quick read. All right. On page 76, Thomas Alban takes Valerie Gray and her sidekick Nancy and their cameraman Bobby to visit the mine. That Alvin insisted on driving them the short distance from the headquarters to the mine. "This is the main deposit," he said when they arrived. He pointed to a shallow pit in the earth the size of 3 football fields placed end to end. Black smoke poured from an old earth mover, gouging up loads of the dry red dirt and dropping it into a waiting dump truck. As they watched, another truck drove slowly down a narrow ramp into the pit. It was difficult to make out a lot of details from the distance because a thick cloud of dust mixed with oily smoke from the equipment filled the air. Now, we tend to think that everything in the Congo happens with shovels and buckets. But, of course, there is machinery because many of the mines are modern mines, and they've been worked for years and years and years. Perhaps not quite as modern as the mines in Western Canada, but they are certainly mines that are developed and operated by some of the major mining companies in the world. Freeport-McMoRan, for example, has a huge copper concession in Katanga province in the south. They're in the process, as a matter of fact, of renegotiating that contract right now. But for the most part, what we're dealing with are discards and old equipment. The processing that happens in the mine is described on page 77. The noise outside the buildings was deafening. Valerie cringed when she imagined how loud it was inside. A dump truck backed up to a ramp at the end of the building. It empties its load onto the platform where a gang of men waited with rakes and shovels. As they pushed the gravel back and forth on the platform, most of it fell through to the conveyor running beneath them, which carried it into the building. Valerie noticed that about half of the men didn't have shoes, or even the rubber sandals made from old tires worn by many Congolese. Instead, their feet were heavily wrapped with cloth, she assumed to keep the grid of the platform from cutting into their feet, although it would provide no protection at all against a wayward rock tumbling out of the dump truck. All of their faces were wrapped with cloth from the eyes down to help keep the dust out of their lungs. There ain't no OSHA in Congo. The people, the workers, are not protected by government regulation. If there is government regulation, there's no one to enforce it. If there was someone to enforce it, there are no courts to take the perpetrators of the crimes to. That's what happens in a country that's in a developmental stage like this. There are so many layers of things that we take for granted that are just beginning to happen in Congo and in places just like it. And that affects certainly the not just the living conditions, but the economies of those countries. There's another kind of mining that occurs in Congo, too. It's described on page 246. This is where Bobby's been captured by the two evil U.S. agents, and he's flying in the helicopter to Mbuji Mayi, which is the second largest city in the Congo, by the way. And as they approach the city, he says, he looks out from the helicopter, he says, the scrubby red savanna beneath him was broken by green riverbanks and occasional small fields laboriously watered by hand. As they neared the mining capital, the scant greenery gave way to harsh slices in the earth and piles of grimy tailings from the mines. From time to time, Bobby spotted deep individual holes about the size of cars, dug seemingly at random in the middle of nowhere. The holes were always surrounded by brush and patches of small trees left undisturbed to screen them from the view at ground level. As the helicopter started to descend, he saw a man crawl from one of the holes and run toward the sheltering brush. The holes were illicit diamond mines, he realized, and the man was running to escape what he thought was death from the air. It's believed that some 40% of the Congo's mineral wealth leaves the country every year illicitly, either through small mines like the ones that were described here, where a couple of guys go out, they dig a hole, hopefully they don't get caught, hopefully they'll find some stones, they turn around, they bring them into the city, they sell them. You may remember there was a scene again in the book not long after this where a diamond peddler came up to the car where Bobby was being held and tried to sell some stones. Well, that's how the stones would work their way into the system and wind up at the jewelry counter at Zales. They'd work their way from the guys that dug the pit to some trader someplace who then has a connection with a legitimate diamond marketing company, and the stones would work their way into the system. Some of that happens on a very small basis. Some of it happens on a very large basis, too, the illicit mining. There was an article not too long ago in the New York Times about a general who runs a tin mine, essentially, in North Kivu province. It's Colonel Sammy Matumo. He's a colonel in the Congolese army, the real official army in the Congo. And he's also a very independent operator. Instead of fighting the rebels in the eastern provinces, as he's supposed to do, he basically uses his army, his brigade of Congolese soldiers, to control a large mining operation in North Kivu province. He takes out, it's believed, some $80 million a year in illicit receipts from the mines that he controls. Those mines are worked by people like this in very primitive conditions. He pays the people that are there. If they don't wish to work for the minuscule wages he pays them, then he brutalizes them until they work. And this is part of the legitimate, so-called legitimate Congolese army. Again, this is one of those situations where when you have a country that's in developmental stages, there aren't the same kind of controls and ways to take care of problems like this that we would expect. It's believed, as I mentioned, that 40% of the Congo's mineral exports are actually illicit. And if you think about that, every dollar that leaves the country, every asset that leaves the country without the government getting a part of it, is an asset that they can't tax, so that they can't pay their soldiers, they can't build their hospitals, they can't build the roads, they can't take care of education, they can't take care of health care, because the country's assets are being stripped. Now, today, unfortunately, what the Congo is facing is the same thing the rest of the world is facing, only perhaps more so. As commodity prices fall, and the price of copper has fallen about 50% in the last year, the legitimate mines shut down, and people lose their jobs. There are over 300,000 people in Katanga province that lost their jobs in the mines because the price of copper fell down in recent months. In a country where jobs are hard to come by to start with, and mining jobs and jobs like that are probably some of the best in the country, that makes a huge dent in it. On top of that, the government itself derives a huge amount of its income from mining operations. And that's undercut the currency. Again, it's cut the ability of the government to provide essential services, which is tenuous to begin with. And when things like that happen in Congo, the government itself becomes even more unstable. Here, we may lose our jobs, but we have unemployment insurance to draw on. In Congo, there's no unemployment insurance. There's not even another place to go for a job. So what do? You look to perhaps overthrow the people that you think might be responsible for this, which is your government. And that's how the problems in the country build and build and build.
I'd like to thank Dr. Joyce Furfuro for the opportunity to talk about the Congo with her class.